This is VOA News in Washington. I'm Jeff Custer. European Union Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell attended the Group of Seven economic meetings in Capri, Italy, Thursday, where he encouraged more aid for Ukraine and restraint in the Middle East. Associated Press correspondent Karen Chamas reports.
In the sleepy Italian resort of Capri, a bell's toll pierced the morning air. EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell started the day talking to reporters about his hopes for the meeting of G7 foreign ministers. Borrell said G7 leaders had to make quick decisions to help Ukraine defend itself against Russia.
Otherwise, the electricity system of Ukraine will be destroyed.
The EU's top diplomat urged Israel to show restraint following an Iranian air assault on its territory. Iran's attack was a response to a suspected Israeli attack on an Iranian consular building in Syria, which killed two Iranian generals. Borrell told reporters,
"I don't want to exaggerate, but we are on the edge of a war, a regional war in the Middle East."
I'm Karen Chamas.
The U.S. and Britain have imposed a new round of sanctions on Iran as concern grows that Tehran's unprecedented attack on Israel could fuel a wider war in the Middle East. Thursday, the U.S. Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Assets Control targeted 16 people and two entities in Iran that produce engines that power the drones used in the April 13 attack on Israel. Additionally, Britain is targeting several Iranian military organizations. British Foreign Secretary David Cameron spoke about the sanctions on the sidelines of the G7 summit Thursday.
Given Iran's behavior in backing the Houthis, backing Hezbollah, backing Hamas, and of course the appalling state-on-state attack on Israel, it's quite right that with partners we take further action on sanctions. And that's what Britain has done today, sanctioning a further 13 people and entities to add to the already 400 sanctions that we've put in place.
This is VOA News. The United Arab Emirates, or UAE, continues to recover from the heaviest recorded rainfall ever to hit the desert nation this week, as rainfall flooded highways, inundated houses, gridlocked traffic, and trapped people in their homes. Located in the Arabian Peninsula, the UAE typically sees little rainfall in its arid desert climate. But the storm that blew through the country Tuesday delivered about a year's worth of rain in one storm, causing massive flooding. There was some reported speculation the storm was caused by cloud seeding to promote rainfall, but government officials said there'd been no such operations before the storm. College of London climate scientist Colleen Gallia told the Reuters news agency the huge rainfall was likely due to a normal weather system exacerbated by climate change.
So in this case, it's likely that the storm was kind of supercharged by climate change because there's just more moisture available in the air for any storm system to then precipitate out.
Members of Ghana's LGBT+ community and activists are waiting to see whether the West African country's president will sign into law a bill that would further restrict their rights and likely worsen the persecution they many already face. Reuters correspondent Alice Rizzo reports.
Gay sex is already punishable by up to 3 years in prison. The new law would also impose a prison sentence of up to 5 years for the promotion or support of LGBT rights, making it one of the harshest of its kind in Africa. Homophobia is rife in culturally conservative Ghana. Hostility and attacks are commonplace, although few such incidents make it to the courts. In February, Parliament unanimously passed the bill, but President Nana Akufo-Addo has delayed signing it, with his office citing two impending Supreme Court challenges. Ghana is also in the grip of an economic crisis, and its finance ministry has warned that the bill could jeopardize $3.8 billion of World Bank funding and derail a $3 billion International Monetary Fund loan package.
That's Alice Rizzo reporting. Starbucks is introducing a new cup that uses less plastic. AP correspondent Haya Pinchwani reports.
The coffee giant says the new cups for drinks like frappuccinos, refreshers, and cold brews will contain up to 20% less plastic. The new cups will roll out in stores in the U.S. and Canada starting this month. Starbucks says frappuccinos and other cold drinks now account for 75% of its U.S. beverage sales. That's up from 37% in 2013. The company estimates the new cups will keep more than 13.5 million pounds of plastic out of landfills each year. The new cups will also include features like raised dots near the bottom for baristas, including those that are visually impaired, to recognize what size cup they're holding. I'm Haya Pinchwani.
In Washington, I'm Jeff Custer. This is VOA News.
Africa News tonight on The Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Swuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News tonight.
Deby says that when he took power 3 years ago, he vowed to maintain peace and order until he hands power to a democratically elected president.
That's Chad's transitional president, General Mahamat Idriss Deby, talking about ensuring peace in the run-up to the May 6th presidential election. Details coming up. Also, the deaths of 8 men are the latest in a sting of what appears to be vigilante killings in South Africa. And healthcare providers report vaccines are in short supply in the eastern DRC. These stories and more on Africa News tonight. We start with a top story, a breaking story. A Kenyan military helicopter crashed a short time ago in western Kenya. At least 5 people on board are reported to have died and 3 have survived. So far, Kenyan and international news media have not identified those who were on the aircraft, but Kenyan news outlets are reporting they include some very senior military officers. We'll have updates on the story as they come in on voaafrica.com. In response to growing campaign violence, Chad's transitional president, General Mahamat Idriss Deby, has ordered his military to arrest angry civilians and make sure peace reigns in the run-up to the May 6th presidential election and afterwards. Opposition and civil society groups, which dismiss the vote as a sham and are calling for a boycott, acknowledge that some civilians have attacked members of the Deby's campaign team. Moki Edwin Kindeka reports from neighboring Cameroon.
Chad's transitional president, General Mahamat Idriss Deby, says he will not allow anyone to disrupt the Central African country's May 6 presidential election. Deby is running as a candidate of the Patriotic Salvation Movement, or MPS, Chad's former ruling party, against 9 challengers. He told State TV on Wednesday that government troops have been quelling confrontations between his supporters and opposition followers in towns and villages across the country since the presidential campaign was launched on April
14.
Deby says that when he took power 3 years ago, he vowed to maintain peace and order until he hands power to a democratically elected president. He says he has asked Chad's military to be on the alert because he will not allow people he describes as inexperienced and power-hungry to create chaos in Chad. He says the military will ensure that peace reigns in Chad before, during, and after the May 6 vote. Chad's transitional government claims that some opposition leaders began calling for violence after about 1,000 civil society groups and 200 opposition parties publicly declared their support for Deby. He said that among those promoting violence are opposition figures whom Chad's Constitutional Council barred from running for president. Among those barred from running was Jimet Clement Bagaou, a former army colonel who is president of the Democratic Party of Chadian People. Bagaou says some of his supporters, including members of civil society groups, have had daily confrontations with followers of Deby and troops in several towns and villages. Bagaou claims Deby asked Chad's military to attack his supporters and civil society members who have called for a boycott of the May 6 vote. He dismissed the election as fake, accusing Deby of doing everything possible to maintain his family's grip on power, including harassing and arresting civilians who do not support his plans. Bagaou says scores of opposition and civil society members are ready to prevent the election from taking place. Bagao spoke via a messaging app from Chad's capital, N'Djamena. He did not say how his supporters and civil society groups plan to stop the election from happening. Chad's military government insists that government troops deployed to maintain peace are not harassing civilians, as the opposition and civil society groups claim. Still, it acknowledges that some arrests have been made in what officials say is part of an effort to assure a peaceful election. Two other fierce opponents of military rule who were barred by the Constitutional Council from running for president are Nasu Ibrahim Negu Kusami and Rakis Amat Saleh. They accused Deby of using government troops to crack down on his opponents in a bid to remain in power after Chad's transitional period ends in August. They claim he is also using state resources, including government vehicles and officials, for his election campaign. Yaya Dzilo Jeru, who was the leader of the opposition Socialist Party Without Borders and a cousin of Deby, was killed in March in the capital, N'Djamena, by troops who surrounded the party's headquarters. Opposition reporter Selu may have been killed because he was planning to challenge the general at the polls. Chad's government denies the Chad's Election Commission, the National Agency for Elections Management, or ANJ, to ensure a free, transparent, and credible vote. Moki Edwin Kinzuka, VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
This week, top economic and banking officials from around the world are gathered in Washington for the annual spring meetings of the World Bank and International Monetary Fund. VOA's Ignatius Anor has been at the gathering and speaking with top economic officials. He's on the line now to tell us about what he is seeing and hearing. Welcome to Africa News Tonight, Ignatius.
Thank you for having me, Yahya.
So let's start with just a summary of what the spring meeting is all about, who is attending, and what the focus is.
Yes, at the heart of the spring meetings is to kind of look at the progress that have been made by the institutions that are holding this event. So I'm talking about the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank Group, and the International Development Bank. These institutions are meeting to review what their mandates are and to examine where the focus would be in 2024 around the world. Early today, we have from the Managing Director for the International Monetary Fund, Kristalina Georgieva. We've also seen captains of industries, finance, economic, and trade ministers from around the world, including G20 nations. Yeah.
And Ignatius, I understand you spoke with the head of the African Development Bank, Akinwumi Adesina, and with the head of the World Bank, Ajay Banga. What did you discuss with them?
The two of them spoke to me extensively about their vision, or most importantly, what they called a bold commitment to delivering access to electricity to 300 Africans by 2030. You will recall, Yahya, that this past couple of weeks, what we've been hearing from experts is that unfortunately, 600 million Africans lack access to electricity. It is impacting the way they do their business, it is impacting their education and their healthcare system. So, Banja, who is the president of the World Bank Group, says on his part, they will be supporting making funds available to provide access to energy to 250 million Africans, while the African Development Bank's Adesina said that they will be catering for 50 million Africans. So, in total, there will be 300 million. Both of them spoke to me about a program called Desert to Power, which they are currently actually mobilizing $20 million. That's on the part of the AFDB, actually mobilizing $20 billion for as we speak, which will generate some 10,000 megawatts of electricity via solar across the Sahelian nations. It's a big commitment for them because, according to them, they they want to get Africans out of the dark, and that universal access to energy is a right for the African people.
And earlier, Ignatius, you mentioned the name Kristalina Georgieva, the head of the IMF, and I understand she will present the multilateral lenders policy agenda. What is expected to be in that, briefly?
Yeah, she actually did, and she mentioned three priority areas for the IMF. One is rebuilding physical buffers. According to her, challenges will continue to arise as the world has seen, from pandemic to the climate crisis to high interest rates to inflation that has affected prices. She believes that building physical policies across the world will help nations withstand some of these shocks and crises as they come up. That's one. Number two is to revive growth prospects, cutting red tape, strengthening government, increasing female labor market participation, and improving access to capital across board. And third priority for them is to renew their commitment to the membership of the IMF, which she says has disbursed $300 billion to almost 100 nations around the world.
VOA's Ignatius Anora, the annual Springs meeting of the World Bank and International Monetary Fund. Thank you for your input.
You're welcome, Ihayas. Thank you so much.
Burundi and the United Nations are appealing for financial aid to cope with the devastating effects of months of relentless rainfall that has displaced nearly 100,000 people. The French news agency AFP says torrential rains in eastern Africa and recent weeks also have left at least 58 people dead in Tanzania and 13 in Kenya. Burundi has been pelted by almost non-stop rain since September, with its main city of Bujumbura ravaged by floods. A joint statement by Interior Minister Martin Antaritzi, the UN resident coordinator Violette Kenyana, attributed the heavy rainfall due to the El Nino pattern, which has caused severe flooding, landslides, strong winds and hail, while damaging homes, crops and infrastructure. They said that between September and April 7th, about 204,000 people were affected, while the number of internally displaced people increased by 25% to 96,000. El Nino often has devastating consequences in eastern Africa. The head of the embattled UN agency that assists Palestinian refugees says that as famine is taking hold across Gaza, the agency is facing an Israeli campaign to push it out of the occupied Palestinian territories and prevent it from carrying out its humanitarian mission. Philip Lazzarini, the UN agency's Commissioner General, said dismantling the agency would, in the short term, deepen the humanitarian crisis and speed the onset of famine and, in the long term, hurt reconstruction of Gaza. Israeli officials have criticized the UN agency that assists Palestinian refugees for years, alleging that Hamas uses its schools for terrorist activities and promotes an anti-Israel curriculum. After the October 7th Hamas terror attacks on Israel, the rhetoric intensified. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. And for more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. Eight men have been shot dead in a township in Cape Town, South Africa. Their bodies were found in separate locations, but community members allege the victims were part of a gang that's been terrorizing the area. The killings are the latest in a string of what appears to be vigilante killings in South Africa, a country with some of the highest rates of violent crime in the world. Darren Taylor reports.
The latest police statistics show that 75 people are murdered every day in South Africa. If this trend continues, say criminologists, it easily will be enough to give the country the highest murder rate in the world. South Africa is considered the continent's most developed economy. But the United Nations says it's also the most unequal society in the world, with millions living in desperate poverty in townships controlled by criminal gangs. University of Cape Town criminologist Guy Lam says citizens are increasingly frustrated at the police's inability to contain crime. As a result, he says, vigilantism, independent civilian action against suspect criminals, isn't going to stop anytime soon. He says two flashpoint areas for vigilante murders are Khayelitsha in Cape Town and KwaMashu near Durban, where 12 alleged criminals were recently gunned down. Lam says police statistics show that vigilantism is a key driver of murders in South Africa.
I mean, some of them have been linked to hostels and control between gangs and fights and conflict over control of hostels and sort of extortion networks and rent-seeking behavior that happens there. Recently, it seems to be linked to an issue of petty criminality of, you know, alleged drug addicts who are perpetrating crimes, street robberies, groups in that area getting fed up and then taking the law into their own hands.
Lam says vigilantism gives communities a sense of control in a country where crime has spiraled out of control.
I think it's important to note that vigilantism has always been in South Africa. I mean, it's the way in which communities feel unsafe, frustrated, dealing with crime and safety issues, often respond when they feel the police aren't going to solve the problems for them or the police are not responding in the ways that they want to respond. It's linked to a sense of wanting to use violence and wanting to use force and coercion to try and discourage this kind of behavior, but also to punish. The sort of thinking behind it is if you punish, the incidences will go down.
He says it's very concerning that vigilantism is becoming much more organized. It's no longer just about a mob cornering a thief and stoning him to death, says Lam. Communities are now arming themselves and taking action against alleged criminals, becoming criminals themselves. On Wednesday in Soweto, Police Minister Bheki Cele acknowledged to reporters that relations between citizens and his officers aren't good, with the police often arriving late at crime scenes.
The response time is quite bad. It takes very long time before they come. So we need to improve on that kind of thing. But all along, there's been that not very smooth working relationship, non-cooperation between themselves and the police.
Cele says the best way to stop vigilante killings is for policing to improve, and he's committed to boosting quality of his service. But Lam says the minister has been saying this for years, only to leave citizens frustrated and angry as policing and crime become worse. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
The United States Secretary General has accepted the resignation of his special envoy for Libya, Abdoulaye Bathily, the head of the UN support mission in Libya, who warned that Libya is on the verge of losing its sovereignty. Bathily said the situation has deteriorated significantly in recent months due to lack of political will and good faith by the main Libyan political leaders and new international and regional dynamics that have turned the country into a battlefield for external parties. Ambassador David Mack, former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Near East, discussed these developments with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi.
Well, unfortunately, the competition between different geographic factions in Libya has overwhelmed the Libyan people's overall interest in having new elections to establish a credible Libyan government that would have authority from all the way from its boundary with Tunisia and Algeria to its boundary with Egypt and its southern boundaries with countries like Niger. And it's the United Nations, supported by the United States and for the most part by the countries of Western Europe, has steadfastly tried to help pull the Libyan factions together. This would be at a time when it's a great opportunity for Libya and some certain other countries like Algeria to build their market share in Western Europe for oil and gas. Because right now, with the problems in the Red Sea and with the continued delays in getting the Iraqi pipeline through Turkey to the Eastern Mediterranean moving again, the oil prices in the Mediterranean region are extremely high. You would think it's a tremendous opportunity for Libya. And I have recently talked to senior Libyan officials who want to see this happen. But the political factions are preventing it from coming together. They're competing for what they can obtain in the way of Libyan oil revenues. And I think it's a sad fact that the central institutions in Libya have been too weak to influence the political leaders to come together. It's a great opportunity, and Mr. Bathily, the head of the UN mission, along with the United States and other countries, have been pushing for elections so that there can be a new credible government, and it just hasn't gelled. And it's an example, I'm afraid, of the lack of political will on the part of senior Libyan leaders on the ground.
So does Russia has any role in obstructing a political agreement that would produce a unified Libyan government through elections?
Khalifa Haftar, who was at one time supported by the Central Intelligence Agency, that was a long time ago, he is now operating very closely with the Russian government and what's left of the Wagner group of mercenaries. And they have considerable influence over what he does. There's a huge interest for NATO to make this work. And President Biden is very much committed to the idea of Libyan elections. But we have not had the influence we used to have with Libyan factions. There is discussions going on behind the scenes to reopen our embassy in Libya. Some European countries have already done this, but it's a risky business given the current security situation in Libya.
So what do the United Nations do now after so many failing attempts by its envoys in Libya?
Well, I think the United Nations is going to have to find a new envoy for the Secretary General, somebody that could have the diplomatic skill to represent the at least the Western nations in the United Nations in trying to reestablish some kind of unity among the different Libyan political factions.
That was Ambassador David Mack, former U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for the Near East, speaking with VOA's Mohammed Al-Shinawi. Burkina Faso has expelled three French diplomats for subversive activities, according to a foreign ministry note seen by the French news agency AFP. They were told to leave the country in 48 hours, the ministry said in a note dated Tuesday that was sent to the French embassy. Since coming to power in a September 2022 coup, the junta has distanced the West African nation from France, which ruled it until 1960. The UN mission in the Central African Republic is urging rebels and militias to cease hostilities that have left at least 30 dead this month. The civil war that erupted in 2013 has claimed considerable lives since 2018, but sporadic outbursts continue between armed rebel groups and the army, which is supported by the Russian Wagner group and militia groups. The UN's MINUSCA mission in the Central African Republic said yesterday in a post on X, formerly Twitter, that it strongly condemns the vile killings perpetrated by armed elements in April in three sites. That wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight on VOAAfrica.com. On behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, we thank you for choosing the Voice of America.
This is VOA News, Washington. I'm Jeff Custer. The United States, there's